WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Do you believe that it's never too late to change? That everyone should get at least one second chance? If so, you're at odds with the U.S. justice system, where over 200,000 incarcerated people are serving life sentences, no second chances, life in prison forever, life without the possibility of parole. More than 17,000 are doing so for nonviolent crimes, and about 12,000 are doing so for crimes committed when they were younger than 18. In a new book called The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences, it's from the Sentencing Project, the Criminal Justice Reform Organization, authors Mark Maurer and Ashley Nellis explain how we got here and how we as a nation can possibly move forward. At least that's what they would like to see. Ashley, Mark, thank you for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you.
And life imprisonment doesn't get as much focus in conversations about prison reform as, say, the war on drugs or the death penalty or bail. But why do you think life imprisonment and lifers therefore get overlooked? Ashley, you want to start?
Sure. Life sentences are considered to be, sort of on one hand of the equation, the humane alternative to the death penalty, right? They're considered to be a bargain. If you are facing the death penalty, you can, save your life by serving a life sentence. And on the other hand, when we see reforms around sort of the low-hanging fruit of criminal justice, the marijuana, nonviolence, first-time offenders are sort of an easier lift. I mean, none of it is an easy lift in criminal justice than those who have committed more serious crimes and more violent crimes. And so often the advantage of passing reforms for low-level nonviolent is comes at a cost to those who are in for more serious and violent crimes. So lifers are often left out of reforms these days on either end, and in some cases they're sort of pointedly excluded in order to get reforms passed.
And Mark, from the stat you have in the book, until 1970, only seven states had a provision for life without parole in their sentencing codes. Today, every state except Alaska permits this punishment. What accounts for so much of the country embracing life without parole sentences over relatively such a short period of time? Is it essentially as an alternative to the death penalty?
Well, no, it's not. And much of this tracks with the growth of mass incarceration, the desire on the part of policymakers at every level of government to send more people to prison, keep them there for longer periods of time. So we had policies like mandatory sentencing, three strikes and you're out and such, that just up the scale of punishment. Yes, in some cases, life without parole is used an alternative to death penalty, but if we just look at the numbers, there are a little bit under 3,000 people on death row today. There are more than 50,000 people serving life without parole. It's impossible to imagine that all those 50,000 would otherwise be on death row.
And so, Ashley, is the thing you really want to focus on those stats that I gave in the intro, that more than 17,000 people are doing life without parole for nonviolent crimes? If that's true, that's going to shock a lot of listeners, as well as 12,000 with life without parole for crimes committed when they were younger than 18. Are those your stats?
those are our stats, and we have many more. Your listeners might be particularly interested to know how New York fares. And in New York, the state of New York, 19% of the people in prison in New York are serving a life sentence. So in order to really make reforms, and New York has depopulated its prison population considerably over the last number of years, but in order to really move that to the next level, it's going to have to accelerate its reforms and deepen them. Most of the lifers in New York are serving life with the possibility of parole, but that possibility is sometimes more of a dream than a reality. And, you know, another sort of shocking statistic about New York is that over 600 of the lifers there were under the age of 18, one of the highest in the country, in fact, in terms of the proportion of people serving life who were juvenile.
What crimes are people doing life without parole for that are nonviolent crimes?
Those are typically, so a fair number of those are in the federal system. You know, the federal system, and so our stats do include federal data.
Mm-hmm.
There are mandatory life sentences for certain categories of drug offenses. Some of that has been reformed in the recently passed First Step Act going forward, but there are still thousands, a couple thousand people serving for nonviolent drug offenses, serving life sentences. So some of the other nonviolent would be property, but the vast majority are there for a drug offense, a third time offender that would end up with a life sentence for a drug crime.
Listeners, anybody have an experience with a life sentence without parole for yourself or someone you know that you think was unjust, or any other question for my guests, Mark Maurer and Ashley Nellis from The Sentencing Project? Their new book is The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Mark, life without parole has now been used for quite a while as an argument against the death penalty, right? For
mm-hmm.
people who committed murder, life without parole was argued to be just as effective a deterrent. It protects the public as much from the killer, but not cruel and unusual because the state shouldn't take a life, arguments like that. Now you're going after life, too. What would you say to people who see this as a slippery slope of criminal justice reform?
Well, I think we need a slippery slope, actually, because if you look at where our punishment policies are, incarceration, you know, the United States leads the world in its use of incarceration. And part of that is that we not only send more people to prison, but we keep them there for much longer than comparable nations. So if you look at Western Europe, for example, it's very unusual for anyone to spend more than 20 years in prison, either by statute or in practice. The upper limit is
even for murder,
very serious crimes. In Norway, the upper limit is 21 years, even for serial murder as well. And so, yes, murder needs to be punished more harshly than robbery or burglary or car theft, but it doesn't mean that we have to make it a life sentence. And the problem is we know that people age out of crime. So the 25-year-old who commits a murder robbery, by the time he or she is 30, 40, certainly 50 or 60, is far less of a risk to public safety. So it's diminishing returns for safety at that point.
Ashley, that would take a cultural change of perception in the United States to think that somebody who committed murder, because we're talking about murder for the most part, should be released by the age of 50 or something like that because they've aged out of the crime-prone years, right?
Yeah, it will take a definite cultural shift, and that is because, you know, our perspective on the criminal justice system is by and large punitive and focused on incapacitation and retribution. And in other countries, the regions of the world that Mark mentioned, the focus of the criminal justice system, particularly the prison system, is on reform. I mean, from the first day that the individual arrives at prison, all efforts are put toward making that individual ready to leave and ready to go back into society. I mean, here that idea is mostly laughed at. I mean, that we would be, you know, sort of spending our time and money getting somebody so that they didn't commit another crime. But for in other countries, that is very much the focus, and is repairing the individual. And in the United States, if you look at the history of our penal system over the decades and centuries, you know, there are periods when we focused prison toward reforming the individual. That's why they were called reformatories at some point. And, you know, why the correction system is called corrections, because there was the idea that it's the burden is not so much on the individual as it is on the system to change the person. But here we put all that burden on the individual, and then we give them no tools to accomplish the task. We take away the programming, we take away the education, we take away the visits, and then we, you know, slap a decades-long prison sentence on them and hope that they'll come out enlightened. But in fact, if we were to sort of revamp the entire thing and really invest in the individual who had gone off track, you know, we as a society would end up safer, feeling safer, and saving a lot of money. So it will take a cultural shift. There are, you know, a lot of folks who feel like, regardless of, you know, what you say about how people do improve in prison, and they absolutely do, they don't deserve a second chance, even if they would succeed if they had one.
But Mark, your proposal, the two of your proposal in the book, goes so far, if I'm understanding it right, as to propose a nationwide 20-year cap on prison sentences, period. Correct?
Exactly. 20 years, except in unusual circumstances. And we believe that the vast majority of people going to prison, 20 years is more than enough for them to essentially age out of crime. Their risk to public safety would be very much diminished at that point. Now, yes, there are going to be some people who still present some kind of threat. One can imagine person convicted of being a serial rapist who refuses to participate in treatment while incarcerated, that person might still be a risk to public safety. In other countries, they have provisions by which you can keep people for an additional 5-year term at a time that's devoted to trying to make them more ready for release. So you could do that sort of thing.
Joe in Cambridge, Mass., you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And actually, I wanted to ask, I wanted to say, first of all, thank you for your work, and I appreciate what you're doing. And I wanted to ask if there are personal challenges for you in deciding, you know, how far you're willing to go, who you're willing to advocate for in, say, nonviolent crimes or crimes of more extreme cases. Thank you.
Thank you. Ashley?
Sure. I mean, given the range of crimes that people commit that end up with a life sentence, the nonviolence are the easiest for me to, you know, personally be at peace with. You know, there are individuals who end up with life sentences who have done very serious crimes and crimes to children and things like this. And so it does, you know, it does, some of reading some of that certainly takes my breath away. That said, I know that everybody can change, and that I would not want to be judged given the behavior on the worst day of my life, and that, you know, I find that it's, you know, better not to judge other people on the worst day of their life. I mean, it's better to have precautions about people who do horrendous things on the worst day of their life. But that doesn't mean they're not worthy of a second look, and if warranted, a second chance. And that often comes, you know, down the road. You know, 20 years is a very long time.
That when you say worst day of their life, it makes it sound like they were going ahead, living peaceful lives, and then had one horribly violent day. For many people, they are repeat violent offenders before they get something like a life sentence, right?
For some of them, for you know, murder is always is punished harshly. In 29 states, is a mandatory life sentence for first-degree murder convictions. So it only does take one murder, and one murder is too much for a lot of us. It only takes one murder to end up with a life sentence. So these aren't folks who have gone out and killed a dozen people. They often have had previous criminal engagements, but that's they're not necessarily beyond repair.
Let's take one more phone call. Paul in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I start from the position that I am not sympathetic to people who kill other people. I believe that they are sent to prison first and foremost for punishment, and if rehabilitation is accomplished along the way due to programs that are available there, well, that's very good. I believe in life sentences that can be commuted under certain circumstances, but basically, I'm for the death penalty also, but I understand how problematic that is because there's always the possibility that a person did not commit the murder when all is said and done. So that's my view in a nutshell. I believe the woman who's speaking, I don't know who she is because I just turned on the program mm-hmm. a little while mm-hmm. ago, comes from a position of being overly sympathetic to killers. She says the worst day of their lives, as was pointed out by the host. Very often these are people who have a lot of bad days in their lives.
And Paul, I'm gonna jump in just because we're running out of time, and I want to get one more response from my guests, who are Ashley Nellis and Mark Maurer, from the Sentencing Project, co-authors of the new book, The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. And Ashley, since he directed his question at you, why don't you take it again, if you're gonna have success making this case. You're at the beginning, I think, of a very long road.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and I completely understand that not everyone is on board with this perspective. I mean, half of the country still supports the death penalty. But I do want to raise one issue that that the caller brings to mind, which is there are problems with the death penalty. And one of the things that I have rolling around in my head frequently about that is, given what we know about the death penalty and all of the problems that there are with it, problems with DNA evidence, problems with execution of the death penalty, literally the execution, problems with the innocence, you know, issue. And so we know all of that. And we have spent so much money and so much legal expertise on the death penalty, and given that we still have all these problems with the death penalty, it just it makes me wonder how many problems of those same problems also exist with life without parole, which doesn't have nearly the same protections. There's no capital litigation expertise for life without parole sentences. There's a very strict limit on the appeals process on a life sentence where that does not exist in the capital arena, and there are other issues as well. So it sort of begs one to open up the possibility that if there are these problems with the death penalty that we know now, what other sentences are problematic mm-hmm. that are All right. Life-ending?
All right, starting a conversation that the country has not been having about life sentences in particular. We thank from the the Criminal Justice Reform Organization, the Sentencing Project, Executive Director Mark Maurer, and Senior Research Analyst Ashley Nellis. They are co-authors of a new book, The Meaning of Life, The Case for Abolishing Life Sentences. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.